pieces belonging to the Afghan Central Bank and stopped shipment of cash to the nation. The U.S. says the assets will not be available to the Taliban, which remains on the Treasury Department's sanctions designation list. In addition to many humanitarian crises, the halt in global aid and the freezing of Afghanistan's assets have led to closure of most COVID-19 hospitals in the country. This comes amid warnings that Afghanistan could face COVID-19 outbreaks in the coming year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Protecting press freedom. Supporters of the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange marching all the way to the British Royal Courts of Justice today ahead of an upcoming extradition hearing. The starting point, the BBC headquarters.
One of the main issues that we have with Assange is that his extradition, the case which is being heard next week, the whole basis of the case, the facts about the case, most of this never gets anywhere near the British media.
The U.S. government is attempting to extradite Assange under an old treaty with the U.K. for publishing damning documents of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and human rights violations elsewhere. His supporters say the charges are politically motivated.
It means basically that every journalist anywhere in the world has to be afraid of a possible extradition, especially if he is reporting on national security issues, not just by the United States or other Western countries, but by any country.
Just last month, it was revealed that in 2017, as Assange began his fifth year holdup in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, the U.S. government plotted to kidnap or assassinate him on British soil. Still, the U.K. is carrying on with his trial.
It besmirches a reputation which at least the British establishment think they have got internationally. It's supposed to be a beacon of free speech. It's supposed to be a beacon of the free press. And while Julian Assange is in Belmarsh.
Since he was evicted from the Ecuadorian embassy 2 years ago, Assange has been languishing in a maximum security prison in southeast London. His next court hearing is set for October 27th and 28th. If extradited, he'll face 175 years in a U.S. prison.
It'll be a watershed moment in the most important press freedom case of the century. And these protesters say they're hoping that the U.K. government and justice system will do the right thing and put an end to what they describe as the show trial of Julian Assange. Saeed Fariza, London.
In the limelight.
The U.S. communications regulator has voted to revoke China Telecom's license in America over national security concerns in the latest pushback by Washington against what it deems possible infiltration of key networks by Chinese companies. The decision by the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, FCC, means China Telecom Americas must now discontinue U.S. services within 60 days. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at Reuters News Agency. The piece is titled, U.S. Bans China Telecom Over National Security Concerns. The U.S. communications regulator has voted to revoke China Telecom's license in America over national security concerns in the latest pushback by Washington against what it deems possible infiltration of key networks by Chinese companies. The decision by the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, FCC, means China Telecom Americas must now discontinue U.S. services within 60 days. China Telecom, the largest Chinese telecommunications company, has had authorization to provide telecommunications services for nearly 20 years in the United States. The Federal Communications Commission, FCC, found that China Telecom is subject to exploitation, influence, and control by the Chinese government and is highly likely to be forced to comply with Chinese government requests without sufficient legal procedures subject to independent judicial oversight. The regulator, the FCC, added that Chinese government ownership and control raise significant national security and law enforcement risks by providing opportunities for the company and the Chinese government to access, store, disrupt, and/or misroute U.S. communications. In response, a China Telecom America spokesperson said, "The Federal Communication Commission's decision was disappointing, and that it would pursue all available options while continuing to serve our customers in the United States." Former U.S. President Donald Trump moved the issue to the top of the political and diplomatic agenda in 2019 when he declared a national emergency to ban technology from foreign adversaries and subjected the Chinese telecommunications company Huawei to strict export controls. In May of 2019, the FCC banned another state-owned Chinese telecommunications company, China Mobile, from providing services in the United States. Former President Donald Trump then successfully piled pressure on American allies such as Britain and Australia to follow suit and ban Huawei from their fifth-generation network. China Telecom served more than 335 million subscribers worldwide as of 2019 and claims to be the largest fixed line and broadband operator in the world, according to a U.S. Senate report. It also provides services to Chinese government facilities in the United States. The U.S. government said in April of 2020 that China Telecom targeted its mobile virtual network to more than 4 million Chinese Americans, 2 million Chinese tourists a year visiting the United States, 300,000 Chinese students at American colleges and universities, and the more than 1,500 Chinese businesses in America. The FCC warned at the same time that it might shut down U.S. operations of three state-controlled Chinese telecommunications companies, citing national security risks raised by U.S. agencies. They were China Telecom Americas, China Unicom Americas, Pacific Network Corp., and its wholly owned subsidiary, Comnet USA, LLC. The Federal Communications Commission, FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr, a Republican, said the regulator must remain vigilant to the threat posed by China. The Chinese embassy in Washington did not respond to a request for comment. U.S. Senators Rob Portman and Tom Carper, who issued a report in 2020 on the U.S. operations of Chinese telecommunication companies, praised the FCC decision in a joint statement that cited substantial and serious national security and law enforcement risks. In March of this year, the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, began efforts to revoke authorization for China Unicom Americas, Pacific Networks, and its wholly owned subsidiary, Comnet, to provide U.S. telecommunications services. It also designated five Chinese companies as posing a threat to national security under a 2019 law, including Huawei, ZTE, Hetera Communications, Hangzhou Hikvision Digital Technology, and Zhejiang Dahua Technology.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. As for kindness to people, it plays an important role in strengthening social ties and spreading love and friendship among people. Islam has urged Muslims to cling to kindness to people. Imam Abu Ja'far al-Baqir, peace be upon him, has said, "Continuous kindness is the best means with me." The most lovable things with the Imam, peace be upon him, was continuing kindness to people, for he wanted to plant love and affection in their hearts through it.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Holy Prophet, has these beautiful conversations and these beautiful dialogues with his friends and his relatives, his companions, his family members, and the people in general. We find that in one such conversation, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam talks about a very interesting thing when asked about some advice as regards to good deeds. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, "Regard the good deed, the good action, as small. Do it quickly and conceal it, hide it." Now, dear brothers and sisters, dear friends, it seems that this is a very small piece of advice in this conversation. It almost seems inconsequential, but really it's quite profound when you open up the chapters which are being revealed in this divine book. First and foremost, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, regard the good deed as small. Meaning, don't become arrogant when you do a good deed. Don't become proud and haughty and in everybody's face, you know, showing off. Look at me, I did a good action. No, within yourself and even manifesting it outwardly, regard the good action as small and pray to Allah that Allah accepts this good deed. The next thing is do it quickly. Of course, we find in the traditions that it is said that shaitan, the Satan, the devil, will do his very best to stop you from doing a good deed. So the Ahl al-Bayt, on the other hand, the household of the Holy Prophet, and here Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has taught us, do the good deed quickly so that you are not dissuaded or tempted from not doing it. And the final one is to conceal this good action. Don't show off to other people. Don't show off that you are doing a good action. Conceal it. Hide it as much as you can. As it is said in certain places in the traditions, that sometimes give charity in a manner where the left hand does not know that the right hand has given charity. Conceal it and keep it for Allah. This is Dialogue Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
What was not discussed is now being discussed. What was given to the masses as the sunnah of the Prophet, which wasn't, is now being cleared up, is now being corrected. So all in all, what we can say is after a time of misinformation about the teachings of the Prophet, along with some information, the words of Ali ibn Abi Talib were around, the words of Imam al-Mujtaba were around, the words of Imam al-Husayn were around, but amongst a smaller group of people. The masses heard some of the words of the Prophet. They weren't all gone. Some of the words of the Prophet were truly passed on. There were people that received it. Later on, those were recorded. Those were not followers of the Ahlul Bayt, who do not try to get the knowledge of the Sunnah of the Prophet through the Ahlul Bayt, which is the source that the Prophet himself encouraged, although we don't say other sources, if reliable sources, that we're not going to hear what they have recorded. But these are the people that know it more accurately and know more of it, more details of it, and have understood it on a different scale. So if others share it, we check with the Ahlul Bayt. This is how we conduct ourselves. This is how we approach hadith. If Abdullah ibn Umar says that the Holy Prophet said something or another, you say, okay, Abdullah ibn Umar, according to history, was not seen to be a liar. We do not have that. He made mistakes, sure, but he was not one of the ones who fabricated. If he says he heard the Prophet say something, like, okay, we will see if it doesn't conflict with anything else, if it's in line with what the Ahlul Bayt have said, the Prophet has said, then okay, we'll accept the direction that it had without the input of Imam Zain al-Abidin, and then building off of that Imam al-Baqir, it would not have moved towards compilers of hadith compiling these ahadith and trying to filter out the wrong, filtered out the ones that are not acceptable and taken and presented those which are acceptable. This would not have been the result of the direction of the Muslim community without the input of Imam Zain al-Abidin and afterwards Imam al-Baqir. And specifically what we're focusing on here is Imam al-Baqir's effort.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It all started in November 2017 when Saudi forces detained dozens of royals and business people and imprisoned them inside the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh under the pretext of an anti-corruption drive ordered by the newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also referred to as MBS. He has gone to great lengths to consolidate power and eliminate potential rivals ever since. On March 6, 2020, Mohammed bin Nayef, Saudi Arabia's former crown prince, was detained on the charge of treason. Saad al-Jabri, a former Saudi spy master and bin Nayef's longtime aide, is the latest high-profile figure caught in the heated rivalry. Jabri alleged in a lawsuit last year that MBS sent a, quote, target squad to assassinate him in Canada, where he lives in exile. He also said the Crown Prince detained his two children to pressure him to go back to Saudi Arabia.
A psychopath with no empathy, doesn't feel emotion, never learned from his experience, and we have witnessed atrocities and crimes committed by this killer. And the warning I received, don't be in a proximity of any Saudi mission in Canada. Don't go to the consulate. Don't go to the embassy. Said why? Said they dismembered the guy. They kill him. You are on the top of the list.
Two lawsuits filed by Saudi state-run companies are accusing Jabri of embezzlement. The firms are part of a network providing cover for clandestine operations with the U.S. Court documents show Jabri intends to make revelations that include matters related to, quote, U.S. national security activities, raising concerns inside Washington and prompting the U.S. to consider a rare judicial intervention.
Well, I would say that Mohammed bin Salman, the supposed Saudi crown prince, never really goes to school and learns any kind of lesson whatsoever. He got away with murdering Khashoggi in Turkey, and the Americans huffed and puffed, and the intelligence services said that he was most likely involved, that the Saudis were definitely involved, and nothing was done about it.
Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist who was killed and dismembered at the kingdom's embassy in Istanbul in October 2018. From Yemen to Istanbul, Saudi Arabia has left a trail of bodies behind. But that's not to say it doesn't target its people within the confine of its borders. As MBS kicked off his campaign of crackdown on dissent, he announced a series of social reforms, including the so-called women's rights reforms, lifting bans on driving and travel restrictions. Amid all the fanfare, however, the kingdom launched a tougher crackdown on women's rights activists, raising questions about Riyadh's intentions of announcing the reforms in the first place. In the meantime, al-Jabri alleged in the interview that MBS had even mentioned his intention of assassinating Saudi Arabia's former King Abdullah, and that there is video evidence proving it.
That's what he said, whether he's just bragging, but he said that and we took it seriously.
Does this video recording still exist?
Yes. I know where it is now. I know there are two copies of that. I know where they are.
Well, the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, is desperately afraid of Saad al-Jabri. Al-Jabri was in the interior ministry. He was the interior minister's right-hand man. And he knows where the bodies are buried and where the money went. He has stated, to my knowledge, that the king and his son, Mohammed bin Salman, have been dipping into the Saudi government funds more than what is being appropriated for them, which, astonishingly, is $800 million per month.
U.S. President Joe Biden vowed earlier this year to press Saudi Arabia over its rights records, but decided not to penalize the kingdom for assassinating Khashoggi. If the violators of human rights aren't held accountable, doesn't that embolden them to think they can carry on and get away with murder in its most literal sense?
The International Islamic Unity Conference is held annually in Tehran. The conference brings together Shia and Sunni scholars and intellectuals from around the world. On Sunday, Iran's Islamic Revolution leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressed Iranian officials and foreign participants at the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized the importance of unity. He stated that the reason for his repeated emphasis on this issue is the large divide that exists across faiths, with enemies attempting to increase it. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the U.S. tries to sow discord among Muslims by raising the issue of Sunni and Shia. Both Shia and Sunnis agree on most of the fundamental beliefs and practices of Islam. Their bitter divide goes back some 14 centuries. It began with disagreement about who should succeed the Prophet Muhammad as the leader of Islamic faith, but the two have coexisted despite the differences. Ayatollah Khamenei further said, "Unity among Muslims is a principal command by the Holy Quran and not a tactic dictated by circumstances." He added that a novel Islamic civilization can only be established when Shia and Sunni Muslims converge in a united front. In his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei also said that Palestine serves as the top criteria for unity in the Muslim world. Ayatollah Khamenei criticized certain regional states for normalizing relations with Israel, calling the approach sinful and wrong. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates signed the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords at the White House in 2020 to normalize ties with the occupying Israeli regime. Morocco and Sudan later signed normalization agreements with Israel as well. Daesh has maintained a foothold in eastern and northeastern Afghanistan following the United States' hasty withdrawal from the country, which led to the collapse of the Afghan government and the Taliban takeover in mid-August. Daesh has claimed responsibility for several attacks against the Taliban recently. It has also targeted Shias in Syria and Iraq in the past. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, touched on the U.S. attempt to incite unrest among Islamic countries through its proxies. Ayatollah Khamenei blamed the U.S. for a recent wave of terrorist attacks by Daesh targeting Shia Muslim mosques in Afghanistan that killed scores of people. Ayatollah Khamenei said one method to prevent such incidents is for present Afghan leaders to visit Shia centers and mosques and urge Sunni Muslims to join interreligious congregations.
Yes. I mean, it's very clear that the U.S. has always been backing these mercenary terrorist networks such as the Daesh, and it serves their cause as long as the Muslim Ummah has disunity and there's this sedition and this hatred that is being bred inside the Islamic world, then they can easily control the region, take over the resources, build their bases, and secure their puppets that they have installed in place.
Ayatollah Khamenei urged Islamic countries to set aside their differences and stressed that unity among Muslims will create synergy and strengthen them in interacting with non-Islamic countries.
Israel seized large parts of Syria's Golan Heights during the Six-Day War of 1967. Most of the Syrian inhabitants had to flee the area. Syria tried to retake the occupied territory in 1973 in a surprise operation, but despite inflicting heavy losses on Israeli forces in that conflict, it failed to liberate Golan. The two sides signed an armistice the following year, and ever since, a United Nations observer force has been deployed on the ceasefire line. International law says Israel must withdraw its forces from the occupied Syrian territory and hand it over to Syria. But just like other parts of Israeli-occupied territories, such as the West Bank, Israel has been defying international law and has been building there. The Israeli regime unilaterally annexed Syria's Golan Heights in 1981, but the international community never recognized the move. In 2019, former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a proclamation officially recognizing the annexation, drawing condemnation from Syria and most of the world. Despite continued worldwide support for the liberation of the Heights, Israel seems to be planning to stay and expand its settlements there. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said recently that Israel will keep the territory. He also pledged to double the size of the Israeli settlers on the Golan, which is at around 20,000 in 30 settlements. The regime has now decided to push ahead with a plan to build thousands of new settler units. taking office in June, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has sped up expansion of settlements, and the new Golan project seems to be in line with his policy. Syria is infuriated by the regime's intensified violations in the occupied territory. Syria called on the United Nations Security Council this week to assume its responsibility and pile pressure on Israel to halt its illegal practices in the Golan Heights. Syria's permanent representative to the UN, Bassam Sabah, said Golan will return to the homeland sooner or later, and all the measures taken by the regime are null and void and have no legal effect. What can Syria and the international community do to push Israel to stop building on lands that international law says must be given back?
The only thing that can be done here is a policy of maximum pressure, either through armed resistance when you are in the region itself, like has been shown by the Palestinians, the Lebanese, the Syrians, and various other groups surrounding the Zionist entity itself, or if you are a nation that is further away, through continued political pressure, through support to the Palestinian cause, and through economical sanctions.
Israel has been taking advantage of American support and the decision by some Arab states to normalize ties with Tel Aviv to advance its expansionist agenda. So it will not be easy to pile political pressure on Israel at the UN or in other international bodies. But grassroots campaigns like the increasingly popular boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel have managed to hurt Israel and raise awareness about its unending violations. The movement has targeted companies that are involved in Israeli settlement construction on occupied lands. The movement also encourages international boycott of products made or partly produced in Israeli settlements.
Well, I think the boycott, divest, and sanction movement is has shown to be a quite effective and efficient method, be it, of course, one of limited means in which we specifically only talk about boycotting Israeli products, but this has it has already yielded some fruit. We know this because the Zionist entity has been rapidly trying to ban and illegalize the BDS movement wherever it exists.
Any new settlement in the Golan Heights could be the next target of the BDS movement.
Israel declared it has placed six prominent Palestinian human rights groups on the regime's so-called terrorist list. The targeted groups include key partners of the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. The six targeted human rights groups are Ad-Damir, Al-Haq, Defense for Children Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, Bisan Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women Committees. Some of these rights groups have closely cooperated with the International Criminal Court in its probing to Israeli war crimes in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. According to Palestinian media, the move will pave the way for Israel to effectively outlaw the activities of these civil society groups, raid their offices, seize their assets, arrest and jail their staff members, and even criminalize any public expressions of support for these groups. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has justified the blacklisting by accusing the right groups of having ties with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine resistance movement, alleging they have provided funding for anti-Israeli resistance groups. Israel's move to designate Palestinian NGOs as terrorist organizations is yet another example of its decades-long crackdown on political activism in the occupied territories. The move has sparked condemnations from inside and outside the occupied territories. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya stated that the Palestinian organizations work with international institutions, and thus their blacklisting is a serious violation of international law. Shataya called on world bodies to denounce the designations and prevent their implementation. Also, the spokesman for the Hamas resistance movement blasted the Israeli move as terrorist behavior. Hazem Qasem said Mahmoud disregards international law and wages a war on Palestinian existence. Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq joined the chorus of condemnation as well.
First, this is clearly a political decision and the continuation of an Israeli campaign that has been taking place for more than a decade, targeting Palestinian organizations with the aim of silencing and frightening them in order to stop them from playing their primary role in defending Palestinians' rights.
Jabarin also urged the countries which support Palestine to adopt a clear position and take serious and a strong action on the issue. Three U.S. Democratic lawmakers also condemned Israel's decision as an attempt to silence advocates of Palestinian rights and called for its withdrawal. In addition, international rights groups condemned the move as an assault on civil society and expressed solidarity with the targeted organizations.
This is a very provocative escalation, but it is, I wouldn't say it's a new war because the war has been ongoing for years now, but it's clearly an attempt to defame, defund, and delegitimize some very, very important human rights organizations that do incredible work in Israel. I happen to have personally worked with all six, which says something, I guess.
The Light.
Meet Clarion, a homemade polar bear whose mission is to raise awareness of climate change in a 500-kilometer pilgrimage to Glasgow. The 3-meter polar bear is work of British furniture maker Bamber Hoss. The bear weighs 17 kilograms and is made of bamboo, willow, and tissue paper. Hoss started his journey with Clarion from his hometown of Bishop's Castle in England to Glasgow. They accomplished their spectacular journey ahead of the United Nations COP26 climate conference in the Scottish city. Hoss says, Clarion is a symbol of melting Arctic ice caps due to global warming.
He's called Clarion. Clarion the bear is not a bear. He is a metaphor. He's a symbol. It is a very obvious symbol that a polar bear represents the Arctic, not the Antarctic, and that is where, you know, some of the problems are with melting ice caps. Not all the problems, because they're elsewhere as well.
Hoss says his aim is to encourage people to pay attention to climate change. Environmental activists from across the UK and elsewhere on the continent have also embarked on a long journey on foot to reach the UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow.
Flocks of sheep are on the streets of Madrid. The animals have made their way through the center of the Spanish capital to follow ancient migration routes. Shepherds accompanied their sheep and goats moving through the streets of the Spanish capital. They actually marked a centuries-old annual tradition that began in 1994. The event allows shepherds to migrate their cattle from summer to winter pastures. They do so based on a deal struck in 1418 that allows the animals to walk through the city freely. The event attracts hundreds of people. It was canceled last year due to the pandemic, but this year, many locals came out to watch.
The Philippines is among the countries facing a soaring plastic waste crisis. However, a group of recyclers are working hard to tackle the problem, turning the waste into building materials. The group is called the Plastic Flamingo, or simply the PLAF. They gather bottles, single-use sachets, and snack food wrappers. The waste is then shredded and molded into post-add planks that can be used for decking and fencing. Their products are also durable enough to make disaster relief shelters and urban furniture. The group says The coronavirus pandemic has worsened the plastic waste problem, sparking a rush for protection equipment. Their disposal is a matter of concern now.
Because of the plastic problem we're currently facing, the pandemic, the huge accumulation of plastic use, there's also improper disposal. People are unaware on, you know, how do I dispose these plastics? Where do I dispose of them? So at the same time, we give that avenue also, that instead of putting it in landfills or oceans in general, you know, you give it to the plath, you give it to recycling centers like us, and we would recycle these, upcycle them into better products.
The plath says surging online shopping is also another problem that they try to address. The group has collected over 100 tons of plastic waste since it started the business in 2019. However, they still have a lot to do. A UN report says some 300 million tons of plastic waste are produced annually, with South Asian countries accounting for 60% of it. North Macedonian zoo has a new inhabitant. It may be small, but it has certainly sparked a big amount of joy. The baby marmoset was born 3 weeks ago. Its parents are super protective of their precious offspring. That's why zoo staff have not been able to get close to the baby and determine if it's a male or a female. The tiny primate will be given a name after its sex is known. Marmosets are the world's smallest monkeys. On average, they are about 13 centimeters long and weigh up to 100 grams. The adorable animals can be found in a number of countries in the Americas.
The hustle and bustle of modern life has made it difficult to communicate with nature the way humans used to do a few decades ago. Now a giant statue in the state of New York reminds us of the importance of lending an attentive ear to our surroundings. The massive statue, named Water's Soul, is located along the Hudson River. Her woman's head, with her index finger pressing on her lips, seems she's asking bystanders to maintain silence. It's a work of 66-year-old Spanish artist Juanme Palenza. He says the message of his work is, quote, to call on people to listen to the profound noise of the water talking to us. Water's Soul was made of polyester resin, fiberglass, and marble dust at a Barcelona studio. It was later shipped to its Jersey City site for assembly. The sculpture is 24 meters tall.
You might have heard of Iran's stellar wrestling achievements or about its soccer team, but that's not all. Another sport has grabbed attention too. Golfers now competing during Iran's national golf tournament in Tehran. This year, 90 participants from around the country played on a very unique golf course. It has only 13 holes instead of the standard 18, but that hasn't stopped golf enthusiasts playing the 13 holes and then repeating the last five to complete the tournament. The good news is that the golf course might not stay so small for long. Iran's Golf Federation hopes to bring in more people interested in golf, but for this to happen, the infrastructure must be provided first.
We don't have the space to use the 350 instructors to train the 3,000 registered men and women across the country, so we decided to build a national academy off the golf course. Course number 18 will be used in a competition venue during tournaments and as a training and education venue during non-competition times.
When the course was built decades ago in northern Tehran, it had five more holes. But over the years, fairways were laid across parts of the field, reducing playable footprint. Tehran's golf club has about 300 members, half are women. Golf has been around in Iran for over a century, and most of the courses are in southern provinces.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from from every corner of the world.
Concerned about endangered animals? If yes, then it will be good news that a Mexican zoo has welcomed a newborn zebra. It belongs to the most threatened of the three species of zebra in the world. The foal made a public appearance Thursday, 10 days after it was born at a zoo in northern Mexico. It's about 50 centimeters tall. Its weight, between 10 to 15 kilograms. The newborn equine raises hopes for the conservation of the imperial zebra species.
We are the only zoo in Mexico that has this species of zebra. Unfortunately, it is an endangered species. Here at the zoo, we are doing everything possible to preserve and produce them so that in the future, we can repopulate some other parks.
The imperial zebra is native to Africa. It is the largest of the wild equids, the family of horses, donkeys, and other animals. Currently, there are less than 2,500 of imperial zebras in the wild. That's blamed on the destruction of their habitat, illegal hunting, and lack of food.
The world's largest Ferris wheel has opened to public in the United Arab Emirates. Dubbed the Dubai Eye, the wheel takes the visitors to a height of 250 meters, feast their eyes on the city skyline. That is almost double the height of the iconic London Eye and over 80 meters taller than the high roller in the U.S. city of Las Vegas. Each full rotation of the giant structure takes 38 minutes. The city put on a spectacular firework and light display to celebrate the opening.
The 38th edition of the International Short Film Festival has kicked off in the Iranian capital, with some 63 films from 32 countries competing in the event. The festival has for the first time turned into an Oscar qualifying event, giving winning entries a shot at the Academy Awards. This is being held at Tehran's famous Iran Mall cinema complex, and it will showcase short feature, documentary, and experimental works. 5 Iranian films and 58 from abroad are selected for the grand prize, and the winner will be presented to the Academy for possible Oscar nomination. The jury has members from Iran as well as Italy, Japan, and France. The festival will be running until October 23rd.
Natural disasters often disrupt normal life, but that's not the case with an Indian couple who got married despite their town being submerged by floodwaters. The couple, identified by local media as health workers in Kerala State, managed to reach a temple for the wedding in a giant cooking pot. They could be seen smiling and waving in their ceremonial clothes while two of their relatives were steering the pot. The couple reportedly borrowed the pot from the temple, saying that was the only option available. The pair was unwilling to postpone their big day, adding an unforgettable story to a country that is famous for many incredible things. Feeling down, it's all right to cry and get help. That's all what a place called the Crying Room tries to tell its visitors in Spain. The Crying Room is part of a building located in central Madrid. It's free and open to the public. The Crying Room aims to remove the stigma attached to mental health, crying, and seeking help. It offers a wide range of services, from a corner to crying, to a phone with a list of psychologists people can call. Motivating messages are also visible on the walls. People have hailed the initiative, saying it helps them speak out about their negative emotions.
I think it's an excellent idea to visualize the widespread of the mental health issue. And I think it's a really fun take on it. call it the crying room, because of the Spanish expression, if you want to cry, go to the crying room. So it's kind of stigmatized to cry in Spain, as in many other countries. So I wanted to take part in this this visualization of the problem.
The crying room was opened in an effort to raise awareness about mental health and well-being. Official data in Spain show that around 40% of people had symptoms of depression last year. Another 30% experienced anxiety.
The first movie in orbit in the making. Two Russian nationals who traveled to the International Space Station to shoot scenes of that movie are now back on Earth. The Soyuz MS-18 spacecraft carrying an actress and a film director undocked from the ISS early Sunday and successfully touched down in Kazakhstan about 3 hours later. The film crew, along with a veteran astronaut, blasted off from the Russian leased Baikonur Cosmodrome earlier this month. They spent 12 days in the ISS to shoot the scenes. The mission beats a Hollywood movie project starring Tom Cruise. The mission adds to a long list of firsts for Russia's space industry. Fabric cuts used to recreate Vietnamese landscapes. A woman living in the capital, Hanoi, has been doing that for 40 years now. The artist, 61 years old, explains what material she uses to create her artworks.
All the details in my artworks are cut from cloth, which is used for oyai, traditional costume, or cut from silk scarves. These are very small details, and I have to get the whole cloth for oyai. I even have to cut them from beautiful silk scarves sent from my friends abroad.
Took says sometimes hundreds of thousands of pieces of cloth are needed to shape the scenes. The cuts should be put together very carefully. Beside that, the woman has to work in a room without any air conditioning, even in the boiling summers of Hanoi. That's because, she says, the pieces of cloth are very tiny and would easily blown away. Her hard work has paid off. The creations sell for up to $5,000. The Vietnamese artist says her work are a summary of the passion and the beauty she has experienced after traveling across her country.
Materials and methods are vital for an artist who combines them to create a masterpiece. Well, a Brazilian artist has used an unusual material to create a huge, dazzling artwork. Mondano has drawn a mural measuring 1,000 square meters using ashes from the burned Amazon rainforest. The artwork on the side of a building in the city of Sao Paulo depicts a firefighter standing near the scenes of deforestation, blazes, and dead animals. Mondano says he traveled extensively to feel that sadness and, more importantly, to collect ashes from for his paintings. He says his aim is to call attention to the environment in his home country, where thousands of wildfires break out each year.
IRIB English Radio.